Please help me welcome Paula from the Newark, Delaware meeting.
Oh, I don't like that thing. I could pull up my... Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody. I'm Paula Gurmack, alcoholic.
Hi, Paula.
I paid them to do that. My anniversary date is January 1st, 1997, and I feel like I'm talking really loud. My home group is the Newark Home Group, and I'm honored that you asked me here to speak for your AA group anniversary. I'm not sure if it's 6 years or 7 years.
Six.
Little conflict there going on, but anyhow, I'm really honored. Seven, six, whatever. Anyhow, I'm really honored that Big Dave called and asked me to speak at your group. Honestly, I have to tell you the truth. When he called me, I'm like, does he know who I am? I mean, I'm not like Dave Perry or Steve Farnsworth or I don't know. I just was like so surprised and honored that he thought enough of me and my message and that possibly maybe I can help somebody today. I think I just have to set aside my fear and let God use me. And what I'm discovering with having 15 years today is, like, I was, like, really good to go for, like, the first 10 years. Like, I was just, like, passionate and, you know, and I was connected to God. And then around the 12th year, you know how they say more will be revealed? Like, I thought that meant, like, more God, more, like, connections. And, like, for me, what happened was I started bumping up against some character defects that they just were running my life. And one of the main ones was judgment. And I don't know if anybody here has run up against that. It took me about 10 years for it to really form. But some people have. I can see them nodding. My judgment kind of came like this. Like, I was following a couple circuit speakers around. Now, it's not their fault that their talk from the podium is about the right and wrong way in AA. But that's what I heard. There was a right and wrong way in AA. And I just, like, jumped right on that bandwagon, you know. And it's like I was telling Jeff, and, you know, I had sort of designated myself as, like, at least the chapter president of AA in Newark, Delaware, anyway. And was it hard for me to do that? Because, like, a lot of people, if you're helping a lot of people, they will put you up on a pedestal, just a warning. They will. And then those same people will knock you off that pedestal, too. And that was, like, the best thing that ever happened to me. So, like, 10 years, I'm just cruising along. I'm helping people. I'm giving up my life. It's awesome. I'm doing nothing in AA but showing up. And I am nonstop working with people. And I am so full of joy, you can't believe. You can't believe how happy I am from giving up myself. And then I started going to school, but I said, nothing's going to interfere. I'm going to keep giving up my life. I'm going to keep doing this. And somehow I started to take, like, the credit. Like, look at me. Look at all I'm doing. I'm going to school. I'm working full time. I'm raising kids. I'm working with all these girls. And, you know, when I started taking the credit, my ego, I think is the best way to say it, myself started to rebuild. And then I started looking at, I must need more. So then I started doing all these, I'm just kind of doing this before my boring ass story, my boring story. But anyhow, so then I started looking at, well, maybe I need to do more than just help girls. So then I started doing these intensive big book studies. And spiritual things, because I'm so spiritual. Everybody's got to rely on Paula. Paula knows all the books and, you know, and all that stuff. And so I got girls coming to my house. You know, I shared this one time, but I had all these girls coming to my house, and I'm sitting there, and I feel like I'm kind of sitting up on a perch, and they're all sitting around my feet. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's funny as hell. And I'm thinking, God, I'm kind of like Jesus or something. So like, you know, and they're all looking up at me like this. And I remember, like they're doing okay with this, but I'm not doing okay with this. Like, I'm thinking, there's something wrong with this. This doesn't feel right. This is feeding the Paula that needs to be reduced, not the Paula that needs to be puffed up. That Paula needs to go, you know. Like, I always talk about myself in, like, two people because I'm convinced I'm, like, two or three personalities, but that's another story. But I definitely wanted to reduce that Paula, and what happened from helping everybody is the Paula started getting puffed up again. Like, it was this big battle with, like, the God in me was fighting the head, and the head was winning about year 11 and 12. So I thought, well, I must need to do more than just help people. So that's when I started doing all that. I remember I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, this doesn't feel right. And then I'm thinking about something else, too. Like, I'm thinking, I'm the only one in this circle of girls that's actually helping anybody. Like, this girl is running around with her husband. This one is smoking pot on the side. And it's not that I was judging them, but I'm thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I teaching these girls to hole up in my house where AA is not? Because you people are in the room. Like, it's okay to hole up in my house, and I'm going to hold court. And am I showing them that they should be helping people, or are we just, like, stroking each other's ego? I don't know what we're doing in my house. I remember running down to Tom Flynn and saying, something doesn't feel right. I don't think I should be doing this. I don't think I should be sitting up here on a throne with girls all around me, and then they're not even helping people. So what kind of example am I setting? You know, he said two words to me. I'll never forget this. Stop it. I'm looking for more. He says, stop it. I'll never forget that. I went back. Now, see, I don't think he wanted me to do it as literally as I did it, but I went back. They all came to my house, and I made the big grand announcement. We will not be having big book studies in my house anymore. Well, about 10 of the girls dropped me as a sponsor. It was hilarious. They all went and had their big book study somewhere else. So I learned a lot from that lesson. And, like, for me, like, I'm always trying to, like, run away from you guys. So I think that was me trying to run away from just the basic roots of showing up in AA, you know, to support Alcoholics Anonymous, because if everybody did what I did, all hold up in their house, there wouldn't be any meeting for the new person. So, you know, and I keep trying to run away from you guys all the time. So that was one of my running away deals. And then I tried that later on. If that wasn't enough of a lesson, we decided we were going to read all the spiritual literature hold up in my house again. I mean, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, you know, but, like, I was doing this with good intentions, but, like, I'm a person that believes you have to give it away to even get it. So what am I teaching if we're holed up in my house? That's really the message that I have to offer anybody. Is I've heard all kinds of things from the podium. One thing I was talking to Big Dave about that sort of upset me was someone had said, who are you helping? That should never be the question to ask anybody. That's just the question my sponsor asked me. When I call him up with something, with a problem, he'll listen, and then he'll say, well, who are you helping? And you know, when I have these so-called problems, I'm not helping people. So I have a direct experience with that. So I've heard recently a lot of people from the podium saying a lot of stuff about, I need more. And this person probably needs the same experience that I needed, where I thought I needed more too. But, I don't know where I was going with that class. But anyhow, so the spiritual meetings, I did that too, you know, so we were all about to pray and to meditate. And of course, I was the leader because I'm so spiritual. And again, it was interfering with my meeting attendance. And so I didn't get a good result from that either. And, you know, so I had to. And you know what else is funny is when I'm doing this stuff, like when I'm backing out of the actual meeting part of Alcoholics Anonymous, my character flaws come just roaring back, man, and they just grab me and they get a hold of me. And it's nice because I've had a transformation as a result of the steps. And so what I have going for me is I woke up, and I know what that means when you fall asleep again. You know what I mean? And so when I fall asleep, it looks like this. Fear, I have fear a lot. Like, I fear doing this, but this is a different kind of fear. And it's a fear of just doing daily things starts to come rushing back. And then I don't like you. I don't like you people. And I start judging you. And then I start judging how you practice AA. And then I start to get jealous again. Things that I lost 15 years ago, those character defects come back too. And all this comes back when I simply stop my meeting attendance because I'm always helping people. It's the weirdest thing. Like, I just want to try to help people, but I want to do it on my own terms. And what I've come to realize is attending meetings is a really important part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I probably had never said that at the podium level, you know, but it's a very important part of Alcoholics Anonymous for the two reasons that I most recently discovered. The first one was always to find new people to help, just like I found my sponsor in a meeting. And then the second one was, if everybody thought like me, we wouldn't even have Alcoholics Anonymous for the new man or the 30-year man that might need us. So my message probably isn't much different than you guys heard me like back in 2009. I'm still really doing the same thing, complicating it every now and then, you know, getting off track with my wonderful ideas that never pan out. They never pan out. They don't. So good luck if you're doing all the stuff that I mentioned. You'll have your own experience with it. But anyway, I'm honored that you asked me here, and it's a privilege to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege that anybody would want anything that I wanted that didn't involve drugs, sex, or rock and roll. That's usually what people wanted me for and what we did back in the day. And my story isn't all that interesting, I had discovered. When I first came in, I thought I was really interesting. I thought you guys couldn't wait to hear from me. Who wouldn't want to hear from an ex-hippie from the 60s? But what I've discovered is there's some stories out there. There's some people that have gone through some real trials. I haven't. Most of my trials I make up in my head. I had not witnessed some of the stuff you guys have witnessed. And God love you, because you're working right next to me in the trenches. I know some of you, and you're doing what I'm doing, and it's amazing. So I just start with, like, you know, how I usually start. I told you my name, my sobriety date, and another funny thing, too, about my home group. Your home group is amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Like, there's hope here. There's a lot of smiling, happy, shiny eyes, happy people here. I can say it. I can feel God. I can feel God in this room. I really can. And I belong to a group like this. And what was happening was the group is doing fine. It was me. That's starting to build up my big shotism again. I'm doing everything right. You're doing it wrong. So I talked to my sponsor, and I decided to join the Newark group. And our message in the Newark group is there is no message here. None. And that's the truth. Our message is there is no message, because you know why? It's in the trenches. It is in the trenches. Every new person out of a rehab and aftercare or before care and drunks on the street come barreling in that meeting. And at first in 2001, when I just moved back from Colorado, it was me and one other guy and nobody else. Now, all my young friends are up there, and man, have they made a difference. And you know what's funny? I ask God for friends, and he sends me people that are like one-third my age. I was telling my other older friends, I don't want friends that are in their 20s. Why do I want to hang around 20-year-olds? I'm not their mother. I've got 20-year-old kids. He keeps sending me these young friends, and they are active, man. They are the most amazing group of AAers I've ever seen. They're carrying their books around, they're helping people, and you can tell that group because they're the happy ones versus the other groups that might be just fellowshipping, right? I mean, I did that the first time I was in AA. I fellowshipped and I ended up drinking again. You're not going to catch me fellowshipping. That's one of my flaws. I don't fellowship. Too afraid. I might like you people, but, you know, so I just love my friends today, and they're all one-third my age except for my two older friends. Thank you, God. Thank you for giving me old people as friends. So, some old people. Sorry. I never was one that really had friends. So, you know, unless, like I said, I had acquaintances and, you know, we had those kind of things and drinking and stuff like that in common. But these are genuine friends today. I know their families. They know my families. And it's amazing. It's just an amazing experience to actually feel love in my heart today. Wow. I didn't know what that was before. So as a child, full of fear now, still full of fear, but not anywhere near to where it was crippling me as a child. So afraid that I'm the one that read books and couldn't come out of my room. And my mom thought, boy, I got a really smart daughter. All she's doing is reading. That's amazing. You need to get her out of her room and get her to socialize. But what my mom didn't notice was the fear that I was in. What my mom didn't see was every time I would read the book, I would jump into that life. I would jump into that life. I think maybe because I was so full of fear to be me, whatever that was, but at a young age, that malady was there, that extreme awkwardness, that self-centeredness, we call it. They diagnosed me as shy with a social disorder. It's a little bit of anxiety thrown in. And the doctor's answer to that when I was young was to sign me up for all these classes, which really terrified me. So I'm really shy and I'm full of fear and I never feel that good, and I'm going to bed at night and I'm dreaming that I don't belong in my family. By the way, there's nothing wrong with my family. Nothing. But if you had asked me that when I first came in, I would have told you my family's horrible. My father's an assembly line worker. All he does is yell. My mother is so severe, she never smiles. That's how I saw it. They were just serious about raising me. They were serious about loving me. I'm the one. I was telling a friend of mine the other day, her father was the opposite. Her father was like really kind of hard and cold. And she's an overachiever. She's got 4 or 5 degrees. She's got a master's. I'm the one that was overloved. I was so overloved and so overprotected, I was afraid to do anything. So it actually fed my fear. So they don't even realize that. They're just trying to love me into some kind of comfortability, and it actually acted the other way. So I'm getting lost and I'm in these books, and, you know, that's my new persona. And guess what? That worked until I would hit, like, seventh grade. And now, you know, I'm being thrown in CCD dances, and, you know, my time period is Jimi Hendrix and, you know, and Janis Joplin, and these are my heroes, and, you know, and Grace Slick, you know, one pill gets you higher, and, you know, whatever that is, and one pill makes you smaller, one pill makes you bigger. I've witnessed that. I've been smaller and bigger all in one day while I'm laying out in the field. So, you know, and so that's what I grew up with. You know, I grew up during Vietnam War, Martin Luther King, the race riots, Kennedy, Kent State, and crazy hippie time, crazy, crazy, you know, Woodstock and all that kind of stuff. And not that that caused my alcoholism, but it certainly was super, super accepted to, like, drink and drug and smoke pot. And, you know, you're in recess, you're not smoking cigarettes, you're smoking pot during recess. I did none of that until about 10th or 11th grade. And I was so uncomfortable in 10th and 11th grade watching my friends look like they're having fun and thinking I am the only one not having fun. And then trying to fix everything from the outside. I'm thinking Twiggy is tall and thin with small lips. This is my problem. I am short with brown hair and big lips. That's my problem. You know, I'm thinking all this crazy stuff. If we could just do it this way or do it that way, or if I could be her instead of me. And, you know, and it was always about how I felt inside. And that's where, you know, that's, I don't know. But so I had all that internal discomfort going on. There's the only way I could call it is a lot of internal discomfort, alcoholism. Alcoholism has nothing to do with the alcohol, is what I'm told. I agree with that, other than alcohol solved my alcoholism problem, though, for a while. Alcohol solved my problem for a long time, because I'm so uncomfortable by the time I'm in 10th and 11th grade, I don't know what to do with myself. And at that time, we merged schools, and some people came in from another area, and they drank all the time. I ended up with that group and was introduced to alcohol. And, you know, just a good little Catholic girl, never drank before, and drank right into a blackout. Like, the very first time I drank, I know some people didn't. And I'm going to tell you something, I thought it was fun. I really did. And not real good things happen right away. Being a female alcoholic, a lot of good things don't happen to female alcoholics. And so that was my first experience with alcohol, and I didn't just go at it nonstop because, you know, I'm young, I'm in a good family, I can't get away with that. And so the next time I drank again, and I think that was the time I was really hooked, big time hooked. We were just passing a bottle back and forth in the car. And, I mean, you've all heard it described. I drank it and something was different. I mean, I remember hearing Light My Fire screaming on the radio. And it was entering my brain at a pace you couldn't believe this, you know. Light My Fire is screaming over and over in my head and the alcohol's going down. And it is, holy cow, it is just changing me into a sociable, happy, wow, this is awesome kind of experience just happened. And I really wanted it then. What happened for me was I always blacked out. I always, just right away, I couldn't stop drinking. And so if you're a female alcoholic, blacking out, and a lot of different things are happening, and you think to yourself, maybe I need to stay awake. Maybe, because I'm not going to stop drinking. There's no way I'm going to stop drinking. It's way too fun. Way too fun. And the other funny thing that, that set me apart from my friends, like I was telling Julie this the other day, I was the one that, like, we were going to Crescendo to drink, and I'm the one that's getting decked out. All my friends are wearing sneakers and jeans, but I'm, like, thinking I'm, like, a glamour queen or something. Like, I got 6-inch platforms on, I got David Bowie hair, I got, you know, I'm thinking I'm, like, going to be discovered. I'm serious. Reading a lot of books. Say, I'm thinking I'm going to be discovered. The other Paula's going to come out. That's what I used to say. I remember I would look in the mirror and I'd say, the other Paula's going to come out. This is going to be fun. I'm already separating from myself. I got two people going on in there. I got the good little Catholic girl and the other Paula's going to come out. And you, I mean, this is what I'm doing in the mirror. I can't wait. The other Paula's coming out. And she did. She came out all right. And she got some really great ideas, too, when she was coming out. And so she came out, and after a while, I couldn't put her back in again. Could not put her back in. So, you know, I fast forward, and I get a job at a major company. It was during a period where I was behaving myself a little bit. But what was happening was I'm a professional during the day, and at night, I'm like a vampire. I'm up all night just doing different things. This is the time where when you watch TV, you really did watch the static. Like, you know, we would just sit for hours like, I'm serious. And that was fun. Yeah, okay, that was fun, right? So, I mean, that's how I rolled. So I got a job with this major company, and I'm doing this at night, and I'm coming in, and I look like a vampire, and I'm losing weight like crazy, man. I'm just, and my boss, God love him, he's feeling, he doesn't know what to do with me. I'll tell you this story. And this will show you the kind of alcoholic I am. Because I don't tell a lot of stories from the podium. I can't. They're just not appropriate for mixed audiences. But at where I worked, a lot of engineers, managers, think tanks, patent attorneys. And there's me trying to be professional in my day job. And they threw a lot of parties. And back in the day, we used to go out to lunch and drink, by the way. Smoke cigarettes right in our office. It was awesome, man. It was fabulous. Never came back to work. But anyway, we had a big party with this company. And it was a pool party. And I always debate, like, can I drink at this party? Or maybe I better not drink? Because once I rolled, man, you couldn't stop her, right? I got to the party. It looked like fun. My boss is there. His boss is there. The president of the plant's there. They're all there. So I decided to have a couple, right? So had a couple, went home, came in work Monday, and nobody will look at me. Nobody will look at me. And I'm like, what the heck? So I go in and I sit down, and some guy from the plant comes up to me and he said, oh, I heard you had a lot of fun on Saturday. Now, I'm trying to pretend like I know what he's talking about because, you know, you're not real comfortable with admitting you're having huge pieces of your life missing. I didn't even know what a blackout was, but I was in a blackout most of the time. I called it missing time. That's what I called it. Oh, I must have missed some time. Well, apparently, not only did I miss time, I missed the entire Saturday. So this guy continues to say, oh, I heard you were the life of the party on Saturday. I'm like, oh, yeah, with a lot of fun. I'm trying to cover up, right? I'm like doing a big cover up. He looks at me and he says, well, why did you skinny dip in front of all the bosses? And then I got to go back there and work another 10 years. Yeah, okay. So, you know what my answer to that was? I got to get away from them. I'm embarrassed. I switched out to the plant and did shift work. Now, I'm not a ship worker by nature, and I'm definitely not a forklift operator. No idea. I don't know how to load drums. I don't know how to load mica. I don't know how to run a plant. I don't know how, but I got the job. Because I got to get away from those people because, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing. That was like the beginning of the end for me. When I switched out to shift work and introduced a substance so I would stop blacking out, I now crossed the line into multiple personalities. That's what happened for me because I never slept. And I'm not exaggerating at all. I really just never slept. And I was connected to a group of people, a motorcycle club that sold this particular product. And they gave it to me, and I ended up doing it all the time. And so, you know, I'm not a very good salesman. And so that was definitely not a real good scene. At the same time, you know, like I said, I started out with the plant managers and ended up with the shift workers. I ended up on the corner. Now, I'm talking about I'm hanging on the corner during race wars time when Martin Luther King was killed, and I'm at the corner liquor store, with my African-American brothers and sisters. And what's fun, and I'm tying a rag around my head because I think I'm black now. And they took care of me. I got to be honest with you. Those corner guys, they had some morals and values. They were never the problem. They took care of this little white girl. It was the white guys. They're the ones. But so, you know, that was like, I don't know what time. I lose track. I still lose time. I'm not even drinking, honest. What time did we start? 8? Ooh. Anyhow, I better speed this up. So anyhow, okay, I think I can end my little drunkalogue and fast forward it into I went missing from work for a full week, and my mom and dad found me and my future husband and put us in a rehab. I had narcolepsy, which means you fall asleep all the time in the rehab from all the stuff I was doing. And I wasn't really buying into this whole AA thing, you know. But one of the things they talked about that really made sense to me was the phenomenon of craving. I latched right onto that. Oh, I see why once I start, I can't stop. I got that. I'm not stupid. I did get that. I never went any further than that, though, with this whole idea of alcoholism. I never really understood or I was never introduced to you're powerless, you need a power. It was you're powerless over alcohol due to the phenomenon of craving. But I know because I read a lot of history that that's one of the smallest parts of our illness. Probably one of the more important parts of our illness is you're powerless. You're not going to remain powerless for the rest of your life, thank God, because we're going to be tapped into that power in step two. So that was a different message this time around than when I first came in 1979. In 1979, when I got out of the rehab and came in, it was ACOA. Big, 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 you know. It's so my parents' fault. It's everybody else's fault. Adult child of alcoholics is big back then. So, you know, we're doing that kind of thing. And I remember girls pointing at me in the meeting and saying, you better share. If you don't share your problems, you're going to drink again. So they were alluding to alcoholism being a behavior problem, which that's the kind of AA I was introduced to. You guys are very fortunate to come into AA where you're being dumped into the principles, these timeless, ageless principles to change your life, to connect you to the power so that you don't remain powerless the rest of your life. I didn't have that experience. And trust me, I was done, I was willing, and I was there. It just wasn't available back in that time period. Wasn't talked about. It was pre-Joe and Charlie, or maybe Joe and Charlie's tapes hadn't picked up a lot of steam yet, but that's kind of AA I dumped into. And as a result of that, I left AA in about 1985. I got really bored with AA. Just don't drink. The obsession was lifted. I took no action other than to walk in those meetings, and I fellowshipped. And we were young, and our idea of AA was we rented beach houses, we went bowling, we took trips. But was I helping anybody? No. See, the message I thought, what I thought I was supposed to do was I wasted all those years drinking. Now I got to work on me. I really, really thought that now it's time for me. Well, that's alcoholism. Alcoholism is selfish and self-centered. So I put down the alcohol, and now I think I'm supposed to be steadily working on me. And I did. I worked on me and worked on me and worked on me right back to a drink back in 1996. And a whole bunch of stuff happened in the meantime. Mike was my power. I ended up marrying the guy that I drank and drugged with. And we both walked out of AA. No depth and weight, nothing of interest to us. The obsession was lifted. No reason to sit in these metal chairs, pews, you know, drink yucky coffee. And why? Why would I want to do that? What are you offering me? You're not telling me I need a spiritual experience. You're telling me I need a personality change. That's what you're telling me. You're telling me to change people, places, and things. I did that. I wasn't going around those people anymore. I wasn't going in those places. I wasn't doing those things. I followed your directions. That's what I did. I followed your directions. And nobody said, get to God. Nobody said you need a spiritual transformation. So, I mean, if we're telling people that today, it's scary. I hope they don't have my experience. Because I worked on myself so much that, you know, I picked up all these shopping habits. I was buying cars every other 6 months or so, buying houses, making my husband work more hours so I could live in a different lifestyle, because he's the problem. It's him. He's not working enough hours. And I love that man. I mean, just he was my soulmate. And he picked up a little Arabian habit, if anybody knows what the Arabians are. So, you know, he's gambling and I'm shopping and we're trying to fill that hole in the soul with all those powers. And it's not that you can't have that good stuff, but it was my primary purpose. The material stuff was my primary purpose. And if you weren't going to get it for me, somehow I had to get that. And it would work for a while. I'd cram it in. It would work for a little bit, and then it would wear off. I didn't know what was wrong with me, to be honest with you, because I didn't want to drink. I really didn't know what was wrong. And so Mike died in a car accident. He went to work and never came back again. It was very traumatic. He hired a lot of drunks, and this one kid that he hired fell asleep behind the wheel, and that kid lived and Mike died. So this kid that Mike gave a chance to, who was a fellow AA member, but he couldn't stop the drinking, ended up really just kind of killing my husband. And I found out recently this guy took his own life, which is so sad. And I never blamed that guy. I never blamed that guy. I don't know why. I'm not like very religious or spiritual at that point, but for some reason I really blame Mike. I don't, you know, but anyhow, so that changed my life. And, you know, maybe God needed, you know, God was trying to get me to sit up and pay attention. I don't know. But I certainly started paying attention then. I started paying attention when my power died. Mike was my power. So if you girls are using your husbands or your boyfriends as a power, it's dangerous, you know. Like, I know today there is only one power. It's like, here's Paula, here's God, and everything else falls underneath for me today. But I had to lose so much to get that feeling, to get that experience. It's sad that I had to lose everything that I lost, but I don't think I would have gone to God and back into AA if that stuff wasn't removed out of my life. Like, maybe you don't have to have it removed out of your life, but I had it all removed out of my life. I had the money removed, the houses removed, the cars removed, the lifestyle removed, the husband removed, everything. It's not come back. It's not come back. I don't expect it to. It's not going to come back. And even when God does, like, give me little gifts of money, I just blow right through it. It's just a terrible flaw of mine. I see something pretty and I got to have it. I see some new surgery, I got to get it. I didn't just say that, did I? Take that off the tape. You know, and so I'm not good with money. So I don't need to have money. I don't. I have enough to meet my needs. And more, and actually more than that. So I get dumped back. So I go back out and I drink again, and that's a boring old story. And I end up moving to Colorado, which I know God has just great love for me, because He put me in a different area, a different area of the United States, a different area of the world, where this was a pocket of enthusiasm like what you have now, just like you guys. Smiling, laughing, carrying on, and God dumped me into an AA meeting there. In Delaware, where I'm from, AA wasn't even a solution in 2001, let alone in 1997. So what would have happened if I'd gone to AA in Delaware? Same experience. Just don't drink, put the plug in the jug. That's the kind of AA we had. And we still have a little bit, but these young ladies are fighting away at it. They got God, their little swords, and they're chomping away at that. But that attitude, and it's working. So I get into this group, and so I get dumped into this little group, and they are smiling, and oh my God, they're happy, and I don't even know what it is I fell into. I've never seen AA like this before. And so I thought, well, I know the first time I was in AA, they said, tell your problems, you're going to drink again. And I am so desperate, and I've never done that. That's got to be the problem. I need to participate. I need to tell them what's going on in my life. So I raise my hand. I say, hi, my name's Paula Germick. I have 17 years, except for the 1 year I drank, and I don't love my second husband. Silence, just like this. Stone cold silence after I shared like that. I'm like, And I'm all like shaking and nervous. But what happened was, and then they continued to talk. I'm not sure what they were saying. They were talking about Emmett Fox a lot, and I had no idea who Emmett Fox was. And so they were talking about Emmett Fox and talking about the steps, and, you know, there was a transformation in that room. You could see it in their eyes. And what was interesting is I'm used to, like, the guys. Well, I was a lot younger then, but I'm used to, like, the guys come running up to you, you know, give you a lot of attention. I'm like all about that. Married or not, I'm, like, all about that, you know. And precepts, I had an excuse, you know. It was the malady. I'm spiritually sick. It's okay to cheat on my husband. So, I mean, the stuff I did without these principles to guide my life, I'm not happy with that. But I tell you, there's a black and white experience. Precepts, steps. I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. But there, I'm in the meeting, and I'm all about the guys, and I'm like, man, there's Indians here, and I just love those Native American Indians. So I'm looking at them and checking them up. Shoot, they know I do. And so, did. Let me preface that. But all the girls came running up to me, which didn't excite me a bit. And they're all surrounding me, and they're shaking my hand like these guys do. They're shaking my hand. It's like, whoa, whoa, you know, up and down. I'm like, oh, my God. And they're asking me if I've been through the steps. And like a good untreated alcoholic, I said, well, of course I've been through the steps. I have no idea what the steps are even. I know step one. That's all I stayed on for 17 years was step one. Never had a spiritual experience. It's no wonder I held my breath a long time. I had a lot of money power. That kept me going. But so eventually what happened was I got taken through the steps. And my first sponsor was a Lakota Indian. And I just couldn't get over sitting down in her basement. Like at first I was like a little snooty. I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting in your basement with a full-length black mink. This is not cool. Like I'm bluffing her. Like I'm trying to act like I'm something. And one day she said to me, you know, you're the saddest person I've ever looked at. Your eyes are so sad. And here I am thinking I'm fooling everybody. Because I spent years bluffing and fooling people, but I can't fool you guys. I cannot fool you guys. And thank God she did that. Because from that point on, I stopped. I stopped acting. I got afraid. I became more desperate. I became more willing. Right up until step two, that is. It didn't last very long. Step two was it like she did what you guys did, what you guys do. Like, I'm not going to go through all the steps, but this is so important for me. I didn't tell you like a really important thing was important for me. I am an atheist. I'm going around all my life saying, don't pray to God, just pray to me. Ha, 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 ha. So I don't even believe in God. I'm an atheist. I only believe in Paula, Paula's reliance. And she was such a good sponsor. She said, and how did that do for you? How did Paula's self-reliance do for you? Look at your record. So she used the book, and I'm thinking, God, she's just such a brat. Like, where's she getting this stuff from? So that kept me there in her basement. But then she said, you know, if you're powerless and your self-will is not doing too well for you, and, you know, the fact that you're always fancying yourself arriving somewhere and you've never arose anywhere, she said, you need the power. And I'm like, I don't even know what she's talking about. I'm like, no, I'm powerless. I'm arguing with her. She said, no, you need God. Psh, not me. Nope. Now, this is what I do. I stand up and I say, oh, no, I don't believe in God. I am so cool. I don't believe in God, I'm telling her. I'm in her basement getting ready to lose everything, but I don't believe in God. She was a great sponsor. She didn't tell me to believe in a rock or a light bulb. I heard one guy say, we're not looking for a geological cure, you know, a geological higher power, a rock or a light bulb. She didn't even tell me a group of drunks. I hear people saying that. She said, I don't care what you believe in. You just have to be willing. I don't expect you to believe in anything, but you have to be willing. I said, I can't do that. I wouldn't even give her this much. She stood up and she said, you'll have to go. And she saved my life. Because then I said, is there anything I can do? Is there anything I can do? She just told me to read We Agnostics. And one line stood out. Who are you to say there is no God? And that did it for me. And then I was off to the races. We did step three. You know, we did it sort of like the Native American way, the north, south, east, west, holding the feather. Of course, I had 6-inch heels on and fell in the river, but that's another story. See, I don't have heels on tonight. I'm finally okay with being little, but, you know, sometimes. But so then I was really kind of off to the races. And then after, like, I went through the steps with her, and she disappeared right before I did my fifth step. And so I was sitting on a four step for a while. Another woman saw me acting kind of crazy and took me under her wing. And she did the steps and handed me my eighth step right at the fifth step and said, here's your eighth step harms list and here's your character defects. Go give it to God. Say your prayer in 6 and 7. That's how they did it there. It was none of this overstudying stuff. I'm here to report to you. Barely did the steps. Barely did them well. And when I was giving them away, I got way more back. And that's really how I learned from passing it on. Now, do I stop at the eighth step with my girls today when I'm helping them? No. But there's proof in that I don't need to overstudy. I don't need to overanalyze. I barely went through, didn't know where a four-step prayer was to save my life. Didn't know where a fifth-step prayer was. Didn't know I was reborn. Didn't know any of that stuff. But as I was passing it on, I was getting far more back. And so my experience has been I want, like, more of that. Like, I'm a kind of person that needs more of something, more of anything, more money, more spending, more this, more that. And I can rein it in, and I feel at the most peace when I'm sitting one-on-one with a girl and the God in me sees the God in her. And so really, you know, one of my good friends, Liz Newbeck, says it's a good place to be when there's no place else to go but God. And for a person like me, there was no place else to go. There just absolutely was no place else for me to go. I had run through everything. I had lost everything. Hopefully you don't do that. I sat in AA and did nothing. I sat in AA and fellowshipped. And then I did the one thing that our co-founders gave us, which is the idea that you must pass it on. I mean, what does Dalai Lama say? For God's sake, don't hurt anybody. Your main role in life, your main job in life is to help other people. For God's sake, at least don't hurt them. So I stay on the side of helping other people. When I don't, self comes back. You know, it's self trying to rebuild, like, all the time now. It's chomping my butt trying to rebuild. So I say, God, please help me. I'm in prayer every night. Please, God, please just remove this fear, remove my ego. I was feeling so good for about 10, 12 years. Now all I'm doing is thinking of myself again. I'm thinking of school. I'm thinking of my grades. I'm thinking about standing up here. Please, God, please. Remove it. And I'm thinking, why isn't God ever answering me anymore? Why is he not answering me? Well, he is answering me, but he's answering me in a way I don't want him to answer me. He keeps throwing you people at me again, or somebody like Big Dave coming up and asking me to speak up here and stuff like that. I think it's the only way. It's the only way for a person like me to stay connected to God is to walk through that fear. You know, I have to walk through the fear. The fear gets so big for me that if I don't do what I'm inspired to do. Because I know in my heart when I'm running. I spent, like, the last couple years, you'd only see the back of me, because I'm always like, and I'm so socially awkward. Like, I use that as an excuse. Well, I'm a little bit shy. I'm socially awkward. I really don't want to fellowship that much. But the truth is, I'm lying. I'm a liar. Still today, I'm such a liar. The truth is, I'm running, not because I'm hiding behind being socially awkward, but because the fear, it's just trying to take me back. Just try and take me back again. It really is. And I can't have that. I've got to have God. I mean, me and God, best friends. I hope it happens again. But so to the new person, it's, you hear it all the time, but God is love. A sponsor will take you through the steps, and you're not going to want to cling on them. They're your pointer. Sponsor is your pointer. Don't try to get them to fix you. Don't ask them for relationship advice. Don't ask them for money. settle with what you have, go to God, you know, because that's what my sponsor's done for me. He's very unavailable, and it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. He's forced me to rely on a power greater than me, and that's powerful. And for the new person, you are going to need your sponsor more often. I'm talking from a 15-year perspective right now. At first, you will need your sponsor. Follow their directions. Best thing I ever heard, we said it to Stacy today because she was hesitant about getting in the car, and we said, just get in the car. This is going to be fun. And that's the best direction you could ever give somebody, is to get in the car and travel and do these kind of deals, you know. And then just help people, even if you think you're not qualified, because God, the God in you, is qualified. So I never thought I was qualified. If I waited for me to get better, if I waited for me to be qualified, I'd never work with you. Never. Too afraid of you. But I just sat there with the book and did the best I could. And I, by far, 100% success for me. I'm 100% successful. And that's like the best record you could possibly have. So thanks for having me. I hope I didn't disappoint you guys. And I love you.